An employer can hire a benefits broker, a TPA, a PBM, and a PNC advisor, and still leave its executives exposed to a risk nobody believes belongs to them. Stop loss may protect the plan from large claims, but it doesn't protect the people making fiduciary decisions. Today, we're closing the hidden fiduciary gap between employee benefits and property and casualty. Let's get briefed.
This is the Benefits Brief, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals. Your fast track to what you need to know to stay sharp, informed, and ready to deliver for your clients. And now, here's your host, former NABIP president and award-winning podcaster, David Saltzman.
And joining us today to help answer that question is Frank Panaccio. Besides being an old friend and a guest of the podcast back in its infancy, Frank is a principal with Gaffney Hill Consulting. He's a nationally recognized insurance consultant, educator, and speaker. He's got more than 30 years of experience in agency management, sales strategy, risk management, and workers' comp. And he's advised agencies, carriers, and employers across the entire country. Frank writes and speaks extensively about employee benefits, fiduciary responsibility, and emerging risk, and about helping advisors navigate issues that don't fit neatly into a single insurance silo. Frank, welcome to the Benefits Brief.
David, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So let's jump right in. You describe what you call a hidden fiduciary gap. What exactly is the gap, and why are so many employers and advisors failing to see it?
What we have, David, is a gathering storm. It's unlike anything I've seen in my almost 40 years in this profession, in that we have desperate agents and employers with respect to the increasing cost of healthcare. Desperate people do desperate things. We have new regulations, new laws. We have the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, and then just recently, in February of 2026, we have emerging and escalating litigation. So what we're discovering is that self-funded plans, although I am not opposed to self-funded plans, carry increasing amounts of risk, well, complexity, which drives the risk. And much of this now is falling between the cracks because many of the liabilities actually have to be handed off to the transfer part, has to be handed off to property and casualty agents. They typically, and I always like to use words typically and frequently because there's exceptions to everything, are not aware of what's going on in the benefits space, in the group health space right now. So we're finding that we have escalating, emerging and escalating risks due to new laws and new litigation, recent litigation, and it's off the radar screen of many agents. Those that get out in front of this are going to have extraordinary opportunities, Dave.
So let's clear up one of the most common misconceptions. What does stop-loss insurance protect, and what does it absolutely not protect?
That's a great question. First of all, I'm going to be a little bit just broad and say it protects what the policy says it protects, because there are limitations, conditions, and exclusions. One of the things that I'm most concerned about, David, is that I hear folks out there in the marketplace saying, that self-funded plans, whether they be level-funded is self-funded, there's no greater risk than fully insured because of stop-loss. Well, stop-loss insurance, like any other policy that exists in our profession, has limitations, exclusions, and conditions. And it's intended to cover claims above a specific or aggregate deductible. That's the intent. Now, one of the things that I find quite disconcerting is many plan sponsors are not aware of the litany of expenses that are excluded, which can be significant. You know, you think about expenses. Okay, I have to pay my TPA. Okay, I have to pay some fees to my broker. Okay, that's fine. Those are not the expenses I'm worried about. Now, what it doesn't cover is the fiduciary liability risk. That's a completely separate issue. And some folks think, well, I've got a fiduciary bond, so I'm okay. No, fiduciary bond is something totally different. It does not take on the fiduciary liability risk, which is a property and casualty. It's actually a casualty line, which most benefits agents, not all, are not licensed to sell. So it is, I like to call it a safety net with holes, David. It most of the time it works as it's supposed to, but exorbitant expenses can hit an employer, a plan sponsor, and other exclusions can hit them, as well as sometimes we see the stop loss is not properly aligned with the plan because many of the managing general agencies are selling stop loss having never looked at the plan.
So now, ERISA's been around since 74. Contrary to popular belief, it does not stand for every ridiculous idea since Adam. What did the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 21 change that makes this conversation more urgent now?
Yes, we actually had, and gosh, weren't those the days, a bipartisan law come into effect. It was actually tacked on to the last COVID relief bill of the first Trump administration. It was hung on there like an ornament on a Christmas tree. But what it did, you mentioned ERISA, been around since 74. ERISA mandated responsibilities of plan sponsors, but they did not have the power or the leverage or the authority to execute on those. And what I mean by that is they're one of the biggest ones, and where we're seeing a lot of the litigation is in excessive fees. Well, under ERISA, they've always been required to pay prudent fees, but they didn't have the leverage or the mandate to require that their third-party administrators, pharmacy benefit managers, the whole litany, network people, disclose their fees. So what CAA has done, the first CAA has done, is mandate that all these service providers be transparent about their fees. They also worked in something known as no gag clauses, which is extraordinarily powerful, but yet I still see gag clauses. And either the third-party administrator or the plan sponsor has to go to a website by December 31st of every year and check off a box asserting that either the box basically says, I have no gag clauses in all of my contracts. That's being done, and some folks actually have them and are checking that box off incorrectly. So there's just been leverage and power. And now that plan sponsors have this leverage and power, they are more accountable to make certain that they're not being charged excessive fees, which is one of the most critical fiduciary responsibilities that they have.
Now, when you talk to folks, I know you make what I think is a very important distinction between achieving a perfect result and following a prudent process. What's the difference, and what does a prudent process actually look like?
Yeah, it is about the process and a documented process. If Department of Labor walks in or you get called to discovery on litigation, one of the first things that they're going to ask for is, who are your fiduciaries? And let me see your governance committee's meeting minutes or your documented process as to how you selected not only your broker, selecting a broker is a fiduciary act, but all of your service providers, and be able to demonstrate, because the overriding ERISA purpose is there has to be exclusive benefit for the participants. Everything's focused on the participants. And prudent, basically, you know, it's not defined anything more than what would a prudent person do, because the definition changes. 30 years ago, a claims audit looked very different. We were actually pulling sample paper files. Today, data mining, data warehousing, 100% transfer of electronic bill data. Every single bill, you can get a copy of the electronic transfer of that and data mine it. Looks very different. So what would a prudent person do today is very different than what it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
So as you review documents and plans for folks, where do you most often see fiduciary exposure hiding inside what otherwise would look like an ordinary benefits program?
Yes, I'm still waiting for the day when I will review a third-party claims administration contract or an ASO contract that is not riddled with ERISA violations. That's the first place I go to look. is, and I have yet to see one. I've yet to see a unicorn. Maybe I will one day, but I don't know which is more rare. A claims administration contract without embedded, baked in the cake, ERISA violations. And as soon as the plan sponsor client signs it, they're violating ERISA. Whether or not there's a breach, or whether litigation, or whether they get audited, it's still a violation of ERISA. And that's like being in the traffic. You don't want to be in the traffic. You may not get hit, but you want to get out of the traffic. I also find that where fiduciaries sometimes aren't even named, you don't have to have all the fiduciaries named, but you have to have one named at least. You also have to have contracts that federal courts have already not already determined to be ERISA violations. And then I just want to go one more step too, David, and it's not quite the same line as a strict fiduciary liability, but it's more, I guess it could be this, and that is the stop loss being aligned with the plan. That is such a crucial thing. I've even seen it as basic as the eligibility provisions under the plan are not in alignment with the eligibility provisions under the stop loss.
Yeah, it there's so many little places. I mean, there's stuff like unreviewed compensation disclosures, unmonitored TPAs. You know, if I've heard once, I've heard 1,000 times, well, my TPA is handling that, so I don't have to worry about it. Well, right. Guess what, applesauce? Your TPA is not the fiduciary on the plan. You are. And you know, the whole universe of PBM stuff. I mean, are you finding those things too? And is any of it getting any better?
Well, there's new laws emerging around PBMs. They're going to be implemented over time. I think the PBMs are under a lot of pressure. I think there's some new models emerging. You know, as Jeff Bezos once said, your margin is my opportunity. I think some new players on the scene, and especially with the technological improvements, I think we're seeing a shift in that market due to laws and regulations, also due to people seeing, you know what, that old model's likely going to go away. Let's come out with a new model. Let's come out with one that we can leverage technology, be more efficient and effective, still make a buck. Hey, we want our service providers to be profitable, you know, but we don't want them to create fiduciary risks and liabilities due to what we would call fees that are not prudent.
Well, and we've seen some PBMs take advantage of that, you know, as they understand that the risk for ERISA litigation is increasing. We now have some PBMs who are full disclosure or full transparency or total pass-through, use whichever phrase you want. And more plans are getting wise to this and starting to seek them out. Let's go back to benefits advisors, because that's the folks who listen to this
right.
podcast. What questions should a strong benefit advisor help the client ask before recommending or reviewing an arrangement?
So that's a great question. And yes, and to that audience, I think what's first and foremost is to what not to say. And what I'm hearing in the marketplace is there's no greater risk than fully insured. And with these level funded plans, which, by the way, David, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, and of course, their new report will come out in a couple of months. It comes out in October every year. But according to their last survey, 44% of employers with 9 to 49 employees are self-funded. Most of those are on level funded plans, which another mistaken or piece of misinformation that's often said about level funded plans is, not only do they not carry any greater risk than fully insured, which is not correct, but they also say because it looks and feels like a fully insured plan because you're paying a monthly allocation, the same one every month, unless you have, you know, people coming on and off the plan. Well, that is oftentimes insinuated or even stated to be your maximum exposure, your maximum financial obligation, and that is simply not the case. So if I were approaching, and quite directly, if I were 10 or 15 years younger, I'd be back in the field focusing on this. This is an extraordinary opportunity for advisors who want to pivot away from the standard ways of the typical ways that they've been doing business to capture these new and emerging risks and opportunities. The first thing I would say is, are you aware your personal assets are at risk under ERISA? And if you go beyond fully insured, And there's some agents out there that think anybody goes to fully insured is foolish. I've had some very, very high net worth people as clients, and they're more interested in protecting their personal assets than possibly reducing their healthcare costs. And there's some question, according to Kaiser data, as to whether there's a big delta between the two anyhow. Certainly on specific cases there is, but over the aggregate and over the course of 5 years and over the big, big numbers, there may not even be a huge delta. So I'd want people to know not only your corporate assets are at risk, but your personal assets are at risk. So we have to take this very seriously. And if you're interested in diving deep into understanding, and I will help walk you through the contracts, because we have multiple contracts and they're exceedingly complex. And I can promise you this, every contract's being written by an attorney from the service provider or the carrier. I find very few employers and with self-funded plans that have an ERISA attorney reviewing the contracts on their side. Sometimes it's even difficult to find an ERISA attorney for the employer side of the table. And so I would make certain that they have counsel ready and available to review these contracts because they're serious. I would also encourage, we have to knock down these silos between the property and casualty folks and the benefits folks. And both of them have responsibility in this. And I would encourage anybody on a self-funded plan to have a robust fiduciary liability policy, fiduciary liability insurance policy. I would not want to be without one. And look, they're all what's called manuscripted forms. Every carrier's different. Don't just shop price on that. You have to read the forms because many of the things that can go wrong are typically what we call sub-limited. You may have a $5 million fiduciary limit, but ERISA responsibility could be ERISA violations could be limited to $25,000 or $100,000. I've seen that. So it's there's a much deeper and broader conversation. Please, let's dispense with the assumption that you will reduce your costs. You have an opportunity to. It comes with a great deal of effort, responsibility, engagement, and potential liability.
Well, not to mention the cost of having your butt hauled into federal court. These are not civil, local lawsuits. These are big deal, big boy lawsuits when they happen, and they're just litigating could cost you a ton of money.
That's true, and oftentimes the defense cost sits inside the limit of insurance, so you can eat it up before you even get to a judgment. And you know, that's something that a lot of folks need to keep an eye on too, is when you get these fiduciary liability policies, make sure defense is outside the limit. So, because they can go on for years. And, you know, here's something else I often hear, David, this what's known as, we all have it. We all carry what's known as recency bias. If we haven't seen something happen recently, we don't think it's going to. And a lot of folks are saying, Frank, I haven't seen this happen. Therefore, I'm not concerned about it. Okay, well, maybe you should let the employer make that decision, the plan sponsor. Get coached up, share, and let them decide whether it's important or not. And secondly, I hear, well, it's only the big companies. The litigation right now, and I you know, Johnson & Johnson, United Airlines, Wells Fargo, those folks, these are cases that are out there in the public domain. Nothing confidential about that. Well, here's my concern, David. Let's assume an employee has a denied claim or they're getting balance billed on a reference-based pricing pharmaceutical or hospital bill, and the advocate is unable to smooth it over. They're actually responsible for that balance bill. They're likely going to litigate. And once that attorney gets their nose under the tent, why not go after fiduciary stuff while you're there? Because they're going to conferences and workshops about the opportunity in this fiduciary liability space that started 15 years ago with pensions and 401ks, and it's coming gangbusters to the health and welfare side.
Well, not only is it coming gangbusters, you know, you talk about Regency bias is great, but, you know, it's like what Santayana said, if you don't remember history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Right.
It was as you just mentioned, as you alluded to, it was fun and games with pension plans that spawned ERISA in the first place. And fun fact, kids, the same law firm that did the tobacco legislation and some of those suits is now the one who's at the forefront of finding plaintiffs in ERISA suits on what we call welfare benefit arrangements or
right.
health plans. So, right. you know, you haven't seen it recently, but you have seen it. And it's, as you say, it's happiness and it's heading your way. But, you know, let's go back to some specifics. You and I, you know, old guys can sit here and go, you know, the way it was. But, you know, sometimes the past is prologue, so you have to be careful. The benefits advisors, you know, they're closer to the vendors and the contracts, but their own compensation and recommendations also may get scrutinized. How should they define and, maybe more importantly, document their role?
That's critical. And nobody says that you have to have the lowest fees or the lowest service fees from your service providers. Nobody's saying that. It's just ERISA says they need to be prudent. Full transparency is the absolute key. And here's where another area, David, that I see advisors are even when they're endeavoring to do it right, sometimes they're tripping up on their compensation disclosure. The law says reasonably in advance of the renewal, you will present your fees, all the fees, not just yours, but you know, your TPA fees and all PBM fees and all the rest. Reasonably advance of the renewal is intended so that the plan sponsor can make a decision as to whether these fees are prudent. I would strongly encourage they benchmark the fees. There are benchmarks out there. You can find benchmarks. And again, you don't have to be the lowest, but you have to be able to defend if the fees are prudent. I've read where I say I've never seen a claims administration contract that doesn't violate ERISA in multiple ways. Many of those are around fees. David, how would I defend a $50,000 fee to reprice one hospital bill? I don't think I could defend it, as my company attorney used to say, Frank, can you defend that in the bright light of day? And if you can't, don't do it. And I couldn't defend these fees. Some of these fees are just completely outrageous. And I don't think folks are spending a lot of time looking at them. But disclosing reasonably in advance, you know, this is the one law, the CAA, the first CAA of 21, is the one law that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of any other law that if agents don't disclose, and the plan sponsor requests it, and they don't disclose within 90 days, the plan sponsor is responsible to report them to the Department of Labor. I don't know of any other law that requires you report your service provider to a government agency. And of course, you have to disengage from the relationship.
Well, because even back in 2021, employers were deductibled out. They were scrambling for solutions. And we were starting to self-insure groups of nine, which back in the day, if we'd even tried to take a group of nine to a stop-loss carrier, we would have gotten thrown through a plate glass window. But let's go back and dive in a little bit more, because NABIP's got a fiduciary course now. They're talking about, you know, what you shouldn't do. Where is the line between helping a client manage fiduciary risk and unintentionally assuming more responsibility for an advisor?
You know, I think the best way to do that is to, and I think you were leading to it a little bit earlier, and I didn't go into it deep enough, David. I think you need to have an agreement on what your engagement looks like. First of all, that's the law. Okay, you're supposed to document, this is what I'm doing. And make it clear, like the TPAs do, although some court cases are pulling them in, that you are not a fiduciary. You're an advisor. You're not an attorney. You're not a fiduciary. You're here to help them make prudent decisions and to help them mitigate their fiduciary response liabilities as much as possible. But I think, one, it is the law. In addition to the compensation disclosure, advisors are supposed to deliver, these are the services that I'm providing. And then in addition to the services that I'm providing, what I'm not providing. I'm not providing legal advice, and I'm not providing a fiduciary status. So I think that we document it. That checks a lot of boxes. One, it really helps in the communication. You know, I heard an expression recently that I really like, and if I know who said it, I'd give attribution, but it's trust is a relationship, but verification is governance. Yes, we want to be trusted, but we also must verify. And that's where the governance comes in, and to document it all. I mean, it's astonishing to me how few self-funded plan sponsors have a governance committee, have been having meetings, have a written documented process on how they're selecting their broker and all of their service providers, have trained their fiduciaries. How many HR people, David, you've been around a long time. How many HSO have I, but how many HR people are aware that they are fiduciary? Many of them are fiduciaries and that they may not even have ownership in the company that they're employed by, but yet their personal assets are exposed as well.
Yeah, it is a big, big, broad problem. And, as we wrap up, a couple of like finalizing questions here. So if I'm an advisor and I'm listening to the two of us talk here today, what's the first practical step that I can take to help a client determine whether or not the gap that we started with talking about exists? Like, what are five questions that should begin an initial coordinated review?
With respect to the questions from the advisor to the plan sponsor,
mm-hmm, yes.
Or the question to the plan sponsor, let's talk about what's your risk tolerance. We know we're desperate. 2027 is going to be ugly. We're seeing all the results on that. What's your risk tolerance? What's your willingness to not just look at the proposal, but to engage with counsel and go through these multitude of contracts? Because if you're not willing to do that, what's your willingness to engage in active involvement of claims that are occurring in real time, or to at least work with vendors and oversee and monitor the vendors that are doing such things? There are ways to reduce costs. We know that. And as I've often get pushback from advisors who think I'm anti-self-funding, which I'm not. Now, David, if you were to push me to the wall today and said, what do you think about self-funding for under 25 or 50 employees? That's a different conversation for a different day and for different reasons. But I think it's a matter of people have to realize this is a completely different ballgame. And it carries, even the Self-Insurance Institute of America, which I've attended a couple of their conferences, even they will say self-funded plans, level funded plans carry greater complexity, greater liabilities, and greater risk. And they are, as they call themselves, the world's largest promoter of self-funding. That's what they do. I think it's important that would you be willing to engage with an ERISA attorney? Yeah, you have a corporate attorney likely, you have a CPA, would you be willing to engage? Do you want to look at this completely differently? And how important is it to you to reduce your costs versus protecting your net worth? David, I know that I had clients that were extraordinarily well off, and their number one concern was protecting their net worth. And they did not like the concept of ERISA allowing the corporate veil to be pierced to attach personal assets.
Well, and one of the things that we should maybe spend a moment on before we go is that a lot of people have very fine corporate attorneys, most of whom do not know how to spell ERISA.
Correct.
So right. you want to find yourself a specialist, the same as you might find a specialist in employment law or any other subspecialty, right? How do you find those people? Are they out there?
They are out there, and I'm providing some referrals now. There's some that are interested in, you know, there's a lot of money on the TPA side and on the carrier side and on the service provider side. So a lot of them have drifted over that way, but drifting's not the right term. They went there head over heels. But there are, fortunately, attorneys that will represent employers. And David, it's stunning to me once again that it's like bear hunting with a switch. I mean, these contracts are designed. And look, they have attorneys with the objective and the purpose, and they're paying these attorneys. These service providers and carriers are paying these attorneys. They're not bad people. They're paying these attorneys to shift as much liability to the plan sponsor as they possibly can. That's their role. That's their job. You could even say that's their fiduciary responsibility to do so. Well, let's not go to that without somebody on our side that can negotiate. You're never going to get everything you want, but certainly it's reasonable to expect that baked in the cake ERISA violations are taken out of the contract.
Frank, last question. If the folks listening to this podcast remember only one thing from our conversation, what would you want it to be?
I would want it to be, put the proposals aside, read the contracts. Read the contracts. It's you know, that's probably my greatest piece of advice, because once you read the contracts, as the expression goes, the scales will fall from your eyes. There's way too much focus on proposals and glossy brochures and pitches. Read the contracts. It will become exceedingly clear as to what's going on here and will give you an opportunity to negotiate on behalf of your clients. I mean, every proposal I've ever seen, David, has said there's a disclaimer in the proposal that I'll paraphrase. Pay no attention to what you're reading here. Go read the actual documents. And too few people, the signing of the contract is oftentimes just a housekeeping detail after a decision was made based on a proposal. But the devil's in the details. My big takeaway, probably even above that, is to the men and women in this profession, folks, this is currently, and I'm not being hyperbolic, the greatest opportunity I've seen in 40 years. This perfect storm, this gathering storm, with all these different components coming together, creating risks we've never seen before. Creating opportunities we've never seen before. And if someone is willing to zag while other people are zigging, the opportunity is just unlike anything I've ever seen, where advisors can not only better protect their clients like never before, but be handsomely remunerated in the process.
And that's a great place to end our conversation for today. Frank, thanks so much for helping us understand why fiduciary risk doesn't stay inside the traditional benefits silo, and what advisors can do before that gap becomes a claim. We appreciate you joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for having me, David.
Stay ahead with the Benefits Brief. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or catch every episode in your member-exclusive Washington Update each Friday. To learn more about how NABIP helps you succeed, or to become a member, visit NABIP.org. That's NABIP.org.